okay, this happens in the real world. What happens on the website? It's not happening. The data points tell me it's not. Test something, test works, repeat again and again and again, and build revenue, right? And that started to allow me to build additional marketing opportunities as well on top of that.
Are you looking for ways to shorten your marketing learning curve and help your organization survive and thrive? Welcome to Relish This, the Purpose Marketing Podcast, a show for purpose-focused leaders who want to use marketing techniques to fuel their organization's growth. If you're a returning listener and you haven't subscribed already, we'd love to have you. Also, please consider leaving a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Now here's your host, author and marketing specialist, Stu Swinefort.
Hey everybody, Stu here. If there are two things I'd like for you to take away from today's show, the first is to always be curious, and the second is to always be testing. My guest today is Matt Randa, and he is the partner and head of practice at Nimble Gravity. He oversees their e-commerce and digital transformations units over there, and he is just a fantastic source of information when it comes to data analytics and how to use data to improve your performance. He and I talked about a whole ton of stuff, everything from how to, things to look out for when you're offloading your work to people who are remote workers, to chasing vanity metrics versus actual conversions. He is just steeped in information about data analytics. And I think that is an area that almost every organization can benefit from. I had a great time talking to Matt today, and I hope you enjoy the show. Here we go. Good afternoon, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Stu. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Oh, thank you for being on the show. I'm really excited to hear more about how you at Nimble Gravity navigate the space of really helping people make great decisions through data. Tell me a little bit about how you got started with data analysis and data driven decision making and Nimble Gravity.
Oh gosh, wow, that's an interesting conversation for sure, right there. I got started in e-commerce in total back in 1998, and data has been a driver of every e-commerce and digital decision that I've ever made. I've been a little bit of an analytics nerd my entire life. And as things have progressed over time, obviously you jump into the realm of big data and data science and looking at analytics in order to drive your performance and productivity and revenue online. And all of those have always been something that's been a part of my personal approach, right? I could be pulling data out and looking at cohorts of customers and their performance in an Excel spreadsheet. I could be diving into a Google Analytics report, looking at that. Or I could be working in conjunction with a big data team to evaluate pricing, to look at alternative data sets that might inform how things are performing in your marketing. I can remember one time looking at housing starts and fuel prices and how they impacted and correlated with appliance sales at a company that I used to work at back in Montana. So all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really cool how, I've been probably not quite as in deep with data as you have been during your career, but certainly as a marketing team, we're always looking for ways to analyze metrics and see, how we can make better decisions. And so it's really cool to hear how you're applying that in a wide variety of ways. That's really an interesting case study with the appliance piece. That's cool. Yeah. How do you see people either missing opportunities with data analysis not taking full advantage of the information that's out there?
That's a great question. It requires spending time with data, right? And making that a practice and wondering and having a curious state of mind to begin with, right? Like, why is that happening? Why is our bounce mm-hmm. rate falling off? Why all of a sudden did our average time on page increase? Why did sales start to fall off in that whole category before they typically did within a season? And those kinds of curious mindsets then allow you to dive into the data and spend time with that. And you have to dedicate yourself, dedicate your teams, whatever it might be, to looking into those problems and giving them an opportunity to, you know, discover something, right? Did all of a sudden your competitors start pricing differently? Did you change a functionality of your website that prevented people from completing transactions? Did something in the macroeconomic conditions of the world, you know, change and impact things, right? Like, we've been going through that a lot lately. People have been talking about, you know, are we in a recession? Yes, we're in a recession. I don't know. And it actually started even before people recognized it, that sales started dropping off for a lot of retail e-commerce companies. And it probably impacted nonprofits as well, right? In the amount of donations and time that people were willing to give in those areas. So lots of different things. Yeah,
it's really interesting to me how, excuse me, when we are starting to analyze data, there are always so many variables that you have to take into consideration. Is this actually a supply chain issue that is creating a delay in production cycles, which is keeping people from wanting to buy because they have some uncertainty in terms of when they're going to receive the products that you're selling? Is it more even, you know, we have a client who work in kind of the construction industry, and it's really hard to kind of pin down what's the actual effect that's creating a certain situation. Yeah. And is that a matter of, are answering those questions, those types of questions, or is answering those types of questions of an exercise in trying to just isolate variables and see how to isolate that data set?
Yeah, it can be. A maybe non-data science typical way or non-big data way of doing things is just doing some regression analysis, right? And trying to understand through regression analysis if other sets of data correlate with what's going on in your own business in some way, shape, or form, right? So just going back to that conversation at the beginning and talking about the, you know, consumer appliance and electronics retailer that I worked for, and we were trying to understand the sales cycles of consumer appliances and what drove those on a large scale, not only things like, well, how frequently does somebody have to replace a refrigerator? Is it every mm-hmm. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? What's the average, right? But what happens with housing starts and contractors, right? How frequently are they building a new development and they need 100 refrigerators? Are they building a new apartment complex? What happens with fuel prices? And does that then impact transportation, and the transportation becomes more expensive. And so the price becomes more expensive to your supply chain point right there, right? Yeah. And then in those areas, you can see historically that, yeah, there's a high correlation between those things, right?
Yeah.
And then you can use that correlation then to predict your future sales as well. And it becomes super interesting to do that with other data sets, right? You can find data sets out there about other companies' e-commerce performance, right? There's multiple spots now where you can go and figure out, you know, across 200 plus D2C websites, how they're performing on Facebook ads, how they're performing on Google ads, what's their average order value, what are their conversion rates, right? And then you could track your business against that and see, are those same, you know, economic factors, market factors driving changes in my business as well. And if you recognize that they are, then you can use that as a good predictor of how things are going to play out for you in the future too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. When you were speaking about the consumer appliance sector, I could even see how gas prices would influence whether or not people are wanting to cook at home or go out. Totally. And how that would influence you know, oh, well, I'm cooking at home more. I need a new stove or a new fridge or whatever it is that, that people, you know, makes people feel like they, that, that they're happier in their current situation.
100%.
So it's just really funny how many different ways one can start to analyze data. So from a starting point in terms of data that you think is important for people to start, like if I have a new business, I'm just getting started, I'm small, I don't have a lot of time to get in the weeds with data analysis, where do you recommend people start?
Well, I think there's some foundational KPIs that, you know, businesses need to look at, and they're going to change depending upon whether you're just a retail business, just an e-commerce business, just digital, whether you're B2C, B2B, you know, et cetera. Are you talking about leads? Are you talking about, you know, people coming into the door? So door swings, are you talking about actual clicks on your website? And then from there, you move forward into whatever your conversion funnel might be, right? So for an e-commerce website, you're looking at things like, all right, how many impressions did we get? What was our bounce rate? How many conversions did we get? What was the average order value? These kinds of things. And those are your most basic data points that you want to continue to always track. If you're talking about B2B, you're going to be talking about what's our lead funnel, right? What's our top of funnel? What's our middle funnel? What's our bottom of funnel? All these kinds of things. And how are people flowing through that and converting from step to step, ultimately to, you know, whatever that sales engagement might be, whether it's a SaaS software, whether it's an actual product that's going out, et cetera. For retail stores, you start talking about, you know, door swings, who's coming in the door, what your sales are, what your conversion is from those, right? You can figure an in-store conversion rate with some pretty simple metrics. And those are the first steps in any data journey, right? Because ultimately, no matter what you look at that becomes more complex than that, you're really trying to change those things. You're trying to change the impact your marketing has so that you get more people, right? Mm-hmm. Or the conversion rate that you have when people come into your store or fill out a form or click on your product, right? So that's where I would always say to begin.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the idea around just measuring, starting to measure something, right? Yeah. And I remember I was in an accelerator program for entrepreneurs organization a few years ago, and we talked a lot about leading versus lagging KPIs and how to, you know, most people start with, okay, well, what was our revenue? We need to change our revenue. It's like, okay, well, yes. And whether that's donations or sales or however you generate revenue, grants, in your organization, you know, certainly that's a metric that we want to pay attention to. However, what are those data points before that? What are the things that influence that particular performance indicator that is really lagging, because, you know, you can't affect sales after the fact. It's like, what can I do before that? And so we talked a lot about moving up that chain and really getting a good understanding of what are the activities that drive the next activities, which drive, you know, the string of activities that then eventually leads to a sale. And so how do we go back and have a good understanding of each of those kind of points along that journey, and then how to influence the top one so that we have levers to pull. And so I know that it's a challenging concept for a lot of people to wrap their arms around. But are there certain metrics, like for nonprofits or even, you know, small businesses just getting started, you know, in that space, that you would say are good leading KPIs or good leading data sets to be paying attention to?
Well, for sure, you want to look at your visits, right? So I had a former boss who said traffic is the lifeblood of the internet. And it's really true when we're talking in a digital space, right? Like, you want to figure out what's driving your traffic. And then you can start to figure out what's happening with the traffic that I have. Right. So figuring out what drives your traffic is the first place to start. And there are definitely metrics around that, right? So you want to look at visitors, you want to look at unique visitors, but then there are things that you could look at even that might not be what somebody would typically look at, right? So you could look at some things that anybody can go test, right? Like what's the speed of your site like? What's the performance of your site, right? And are you doing things like passing core web vitals? So, you know, your audience might be aware of this, they might not. Core web vitals is a set of statistics about a website essentially that talk about its performance. How much content is being pumped into the page? What are the times before it becomes interactive? How much layout shift occurs on your page? These kinds of experiential things. And that helps search engines like Google, obviously, then rank your site and give it some indication of this site performs really well, this site doesn't perform well, this site changes all the time, this site has very long lagging delays of when it loads before it's interactive. And they will start to rank you off of that, right? And so those impact your traffic. So Core Web Vitals is one of those things that people can go pay attention to. And they can go to pagespeed.web.dev, right? And search out their own website and figure out how am I performing on these things. And what's great about that particular site is it'll tell you exactly how you're performing, and it'll tell you exactly what the things are that are causing you to perform poorly, right? And those are things that could be impacting your organic traffic, right? And how much of that is coming through to your site. And a lot of smaller businesses, a lot of nonprofits are probably going to rely a heck of a lot more on organic traffic than they are on paid traffic, just because if you have to make a choice of where you're going to spend, it's a lot easier to put man hours into working on your SEO than it is to pull dollars out of your pocket and pay for those things.
Sure. Yeah. Another way for people to look at their core vitals is to do an inspection on their site through Chrome and look at Lighthouse results. That gives you a whole set of information that you can act upon to make adjustments to your site to try and improve speed or get rid of unnecessary page load stuff. It's a really valuable tool, and it's certainly something that Google is looking at. It's really fun too to dive into analytics and start to really kind of get a good feel for not only, you know, is this organic traffic, is this social traffic, is it paid search, you know, how people are originally getting to your site, but also diving deeper into those individual sets. So, you know, if you have a good understanding that, let's say, 30% of your traffic comes from social, well, that's amazing. But which of the social channels that you're playing in is driving the most traffic? So diving even just one level deeper can get you some additional information that you can act upon in terms of where should you be spending your time and energy.
Totally. You can find fun things like that too, right? Like you could also find in that example that you're talking about that, say, Facebook's driving more users, but they convert at half the rate of the users that come from Instagram or from LinkedIn or wherever else it might be, right? And so you might say to yourself, I'm actually going to change my mix. I don't want those non-converting users. I want the users that are going to convert. I'm going to double down on that secondary platform and see if I can drive more people there.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating how we get caught up in vanity metrics in terms of really, you know, we will have clients come to us and say, yeah, I just want hits. I just want people coming to the site. And it's like, okay, well, that's great. We can certainly help with that. However, would you rather have 1 million people come to the site, or would you rather have 1,000 people come who actually do something, right? Who take action? And when you start to have those kinds of conversations, and certainly there's something to be said for just sheer volume, and not everyone's ready to buy the first time they come, you know, the first time they meet you or see you. Yeah. So, you know, driving traffic is just, I think, on its face very important. However, driving the right kind of traffic and converting traffic can be a lot more important at certain times during the life cycle of one's organization or business.
Totally.
So what are the types of services that your team provides to organizations who are looking to have a better understanding of you know, how they're performing and what they should be doing?
Yeah, great question. So, we work across a wide variety of areas. We're really a collaborative team of experts who are passionate about the power of data. And we've got not only the e-commerce and digital transformation practices that I oversee, but we also work in data science. We do analytics and BI, and then we do both organizational and management strategy. And we have a global engineering team as well. And when I say global engineering, people have probably previously heard that phrased as nearshoring or offshoring for development teams. But quite frankly, what we've found is that we like to go where pools of talent exist, and there's great talent to be found in lots of different areas. And then secondarily, we also like to align those teams that we're building with the clients that they're working with, right? If you're talking about offshoring and you get 2 hours of time a day with your team that's in some other part of the world, that's not as good as if you can do what's, you know, nearshoring or locating close to time zone wise, and you can get 6 hours, 7 hours, maybe 8 hours of overlapping time. So we really work to put people in the right places together.
Yeah, that's great to have the high touch clients aligned with people that are going to be, you know, awake at the same times is pretty important.
Totally.
Have you found that your remote teams are, what are some of the things as people, I know that there are a lot of people out there who are looking for opportunities and options for remote work and, for leveraging remote work, what are some of the things that you would recommend people look out for or pay attention to when they're starting to make that kind of a decision?
Oh, that's a great question. So we do remote work across a wide variety of our practice areas, right? I have people on my team specifically who are located in Mexico City, who are located in Michigan. They're not just here in Colorado with me, right? And even frequently, those of us that are here in Colorado work from our homes rather than going into an office location. So the first thing that I typically look for in those kinds of people are they good problem solvers, right? Because when you're off on your own outside of an office, you're frequently going to be challenged with solving some kind of problem. What do we typically do in this scenario? How do we handle this? And if you have somebody who's a good problem solver, then they're not going to be sitting around waiting for that time where they can break into your meeting schedule, into your calendar to ask you questions, right? They're going to be problem solving and empowering them to do that, having that conversation with them from the start of like, this is the expectation and here's why. And I trust you as a human, right? It's okay to make a mistake too, right? So there's that at a base level, right? Allowing for mistakes, allowing for failures, correcting those, hiring problem solvers, these kinds of things. If you're talking about hiring teams of people who exist to work for your organization outside of your organization, maybe they're even more remote in the sense that they're contractors, not just direct employees, right? Then you have to start looking out for things across the board, right? Does it require a legal entity to hire these people inside of another country? Do you have to have certain payment agreements? Is there a union requirement for those types of workers in the country that you're hiring for? And those become complexities that some companies don't want to deal with, and they would rather hire an agency that can provide coverage on all of those areas. So you have to make that choice as a business, right? And then you want to start thinking about those kinds of things of, is the talent in the place that we're going, right? Like, I wouldn't even put is the time overlap, right? Right. Do they have the talent that we need to develop this set-top box application, to develop this mobile application? Are they best in class, right? You can find fantastic developers who have worked for places like Google, Facebook, Shopify, et cetera, in other places of the world than just Silicon Valley or Seattle or wherever, right? They exist all over.
And yeah, it sounds like letting go of the idea of you need these people to work at specific times and really embracing the idea of you just need these people to be great at what they do.
Yeah, you need people to deliver products at the deadline that your clients asked you to deliver them for, not to work from 8 to 5 Mountain Standard Time, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. It's funny though, I was actually on a call earlier today where I was chatting with a guy just about old school business practices and how people haven't been able to let go of the idea that I need these people in my office. The time thing is something that I think people need to let go of.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Have you guys had good success with that?
We have actually. Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned I've got somebody in Michigan. We work with people in, you know, the UK. We have most of our current teams that we've built for other clients inside of, you know, North American time zone equivalents, but a lot of them happen to be in South and Central America. We've got folks in, you know, Argentina. We're just now opening offices in Colombia, all these kinds of places. And we're doing it because the talent's there, right? And yeah. And it is coincidentally aligns fantastically time zone wise.
So. Yeah, exactly. There's a growing expat community that is, you know, starting to live in Central and South America, I know. So it's not like you even necessarily have a language barrier that you need to overcome because you're just working with someone who used to live in the US and now is living in Mexico or Venezuela or wherever. Yeah. So it's really cool to be able to tap into that. Thanks for the insights. I think that's some amazing stuff to consider for sure when people are thinking about that kind of, you know, team building piece. So in terms of, you know, back to data science and data analysis, I know that you mentioned that you've worked with a few nonprofits. What are some of the things that you recommend nonprofits stay on top of, or things that they should start to consider when trying to increase their reach or their ability to serve, serve their mission or gain new followers and revenue?
Yeah. So nonprofits, just like any other business, have troves of data that can be analyzed, right? Like, think about donor data, right? And the ability that you can have to figure out who's my ideal donor and mm-hmm. where do they go? So if you had a simple customer data platform as a nonprofit, and you were able to track your particular donors and or customers, right? There are plenty of businesses that are nonprofits that have customers rather than donors. You can start to find these ideal prospects, and you can start to track them based upon what are the average demographics, what are the media that these people go to, and you can use things like web tools that allow you to see where audiences go, and have similar audiences. You can target these audiences in advertising through programmatic advertising. So those are all things that I would look at. I would look at my donor data and my customer data and try to understand who these people are, where are they coming to us from, what's most popular, and then how do I get more of these people and approach things like that. Other things go ahead.
No, please go for it.
I was just going to say other things that I would think about as a nonprofit too is, you know, not only is good talent just plain old hard to find in the US right now. I don't want to use it as a, you know, a selling point, because I don't think it really should be, but there is a cost savings to not having development work done in the US, right? But you have the same talent outside of the US. So mm-hmm. you can leverage that as an opportunity to advance your technical capabilities, your product, whatever it might be that you're working on. Maybe you're, you know, a nonprofit that has been wanting to launch and build a mobile app for a really long time, but it's just felt like it's too darn expensive to do from everybody who's ever quoted you anything in the United States, right? There are other options out there, and they're not all as expensive as what you might have heard before.
So. Yeah. Do you typically recommend nonprofits and starting with Google Analytics to try and get that some of that insight into donor behavior and information? I know, you know, Google does have some demographic information, or do you recommend they run their own data collection via surveys or the like? Where would somebody start?
Surveys are fantastic. They're going to get you a lot of data that you aren't going to find, but there are tools out there even that will tell you about your audience based upon their social behaviors. And they aren't going to necessarily identify that Stu's handle and Matt's social profile handles are here and they go and they do these things. They're going to look at the totality of your audience and follow them across, you know, their activities and give you some understanding back. And there are some tools out there that are very inexpensive. So Spark Toro happens to be one of those. That's SparkToro. It was founded by Rand Fishkin, who used to be part of SEO Moz, you know, internet guru, great guy. And that tool will allow you to compare audiences, right? So say you know of a business similar to yours that you envy their traffic and their approach to things, you can go figure out what their audience is up to, what they talk about, what their demographics are, what major cities they're in, these kinds of things by searching them out on a tool like Spark Toro. Or there's another one out there called Audience. And it, instead of ENCE, it's ENSE at the end. And those kinds of tools give you that little bit deeper insight that you might not necessarily get with those demographic and affinity kind of details that Google has. They just are going to augment them, right? And give you even more powerful data to go and target your audience with.
Yeah, I know that as people start out, they just have no idea where to even turn to start to get that kind of information. They may have an understanding that they're interested in that and that would be very helpful and beneficial, but like, how do I even start? So thank you for sharing those two tools that can help people start to dig into that audience demographic stuff. That's fantastic. So in terms of people's ability or people's reach, what are some of the things that you've seen companies do to improve the way that they're getting in front of their audiences based upon some of the data that they've collected? Are there any unique ways that they've leveraged that data or leveraged the ability to make those decisions that you've seen that are kind of unique or interesting?
There's a lot out there. I have one personal example from my past life that's coming to mind. So I was able to identify a challenge that existed on a website I used to run that was called Veracal.com. It's part of Arrow Electronics, and it's a global components electronic components marketplace, right? And as a platform, that website sells into 156 different countries around the world. And I started to understand the business in totality from a global perspective over the course of managing it, and could see that we weren't getting as much of our sales from certain countries in Europe as the rest of the non-digital business was getting from direct field sales, right? And so I went in and I looked at the data in Google Analytics and looked at just the conversion rates, the bounce rates, the time on page for what I understood at the time to be the biggest countries driving the most revenue for our field sales folks in Europe for Aero at that point in time. And I could see right away that there were drastic differences in those countries and their performance, right? Rather than having, an industry standard conversion rate, they were converting at like 0.5% or less, right? So it's instantly like, oh, trigger, something's going on here, right? Mm-hmm. And the easy hypothesis that came out of that is that they don't understand the site. It's not in their language. They don't know, how to get extra details. They don't know which button to click for a shopping cart. They don't know how to pick between the multiple options that exist because it's all in English. And so started to test that theory out and eventually found that translating our site into 6 other languages resulted in being able to raise revenues by 32%. And it's a very, straightforward data exercise of understanding, okay, this happens in the real world. What happens on the website? It's not happening. The data points tell me it's not. Test something. Test works. Repeat again and again and again and build revenue, right? And right. That started to allow me to build additional marketing opportunities as well on top of that. So, there's that kind of thing as well. There's also just flat out good old A/B testing, right? And I would encourage, I told a group of startup folks that I was talking with just last week, about a week ago, this, I would change that old adage that salespeople have of always be closing to having a digital adage of always be testing.
Yeah.
Always be testing. Change your form around. Add one question. Take a question away. Make your button bigger. Make it a different color. Like run A/B tests constantly. We had a client recently that we were able to improve, sales by 50%, gross margins by 6% on another, like all kinds of fun stuff, right? So it's testing that will get you ahead in that world.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at what you're not getting and see how to improve upon that. I mean, I know that just here at Relish, over the course of our 14 or however many years we've been doing this, we missed out on a lot of sales. And you start to think about, well, gosh, if I could figure out how to improve my close rate by, even 5%, what kind of revenue would that have generated? And
right.
And then you just start thinking about ways to just to test out that theory and test out ways to improve that and then improve upon the improvements. And all of a sudden you have a lot more revenue based upon opportunity that's already there. It's not like you have to recreate, that opportunity. So that's really great advice to always be testing. When nonprofits do test, is there, it probably depends on how much traffic they have and how, how significant the improvement or whatever the opposite of improvement is, but how long do you typically recommend people, perform a test?
Yeah. So typically when you have enough traffic, you're going to see a test complete in, let's say, 3 weeks on average.
Okay.
Sometimes less, maybe more, depends upon the test that you're doing, to your point, how many visits are driving through it, these kinds of things. And then, you do bring up a great point. It does require a minimum level of traffic before it becomes statistically relevant, right? Mm-hmm. And in some instances, you may find that platforms aren't going to give you enough statistical relevance, like a Google Optimize or something like that, that people might use to test. And then in that scenario, what I would say is, okay, don't rely on statistical relevance. Rely on your core KPIs again, right? Mm-hmm. Did you make a change and did nothing negative happen? Right? Did your bounce rate stay the same? Did your conversion rate stay the same? Did your average order value, your average donation, did these all stay the same? You're probably okay. Did they get better? Right? Like, you can test these things without, like, just make one change. Don't change 57 things at one time.
Yep. Right?
Make one change, watch what happens. And if it's positive or status quo, go for it and make the next one. Right. And there's e-commerce 101 type things that you can do. There's digital performance type things that you can do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't tell you how many times, Stu, I will go visit a website and their contact information is buried in the footer. It's off on some other page. Like, you can't immediately get to it and find it quickly, right? Or search bars, same kind of thing. They'll have like some teeny tiny magnifying glass in a very low contrast color, you know, over in the corner. And those kinds of things, go change those. Make your search box bigger. Make your contact information really prominent. Don't be afraid of doing it. It will help your business. It will help your donations. It will help your time on page, whatever it might be.
Right, right. Do you have a feel for, I mean, there's probably not a number necessarily, but what if somebody's trying to make a decision in terms of statistical relevance and you know, amount of say traffic that needs to be coming through to have a good belief that a change was either successful or unsuccessful. Do you have a feel for what that number or what that volume might be for different organizations, or does it vary so widely that there's no real?
It varies pretty widely in what statistical relevance is. And there are lots of calculators out there on the internet. You can go find statistical relevance calculator, do a search for it, right? And you'll find that you might need 300 responses to a survey, or you might need, mm-hmm. you know, 500 responses, or you may need 1,200 in order for the data to be statistically relevant to your particular audience. And sometimes that can be a pretty large audience. You could still be talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, where that low number would still give you statistical relevance. It might be not as accurate in its relevance, mm-hmm. but it would still be relevant. Typically, when you're talking about like those A/B testing platforms that people will install, that's frequently going to be in the thousands, if not tens of thousands of results that they want to drive through each of the variations before mm-hmm. they'll commit to one being, you know, the winner.
Okay. Gotcha. That's good to know. You also mentioned a tool, excuse me, that Google has that allows you to run A/B type testing. It's Google Optimize. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And that one, if my memory serves, allows you to dynamically throw in different messaging onto a single page so that you can then test the traffic, you know, what the end result of that message is. So for example, if you want to test a button, verbiage, you could throw different calls to action on that button. And then Google separates that traffic and gives you an understanding of which one performed more correctly. Right.
100%. That's exactly it. Yep.
Do you see that as a tool that most people should be using if they, in the absence of some other mechanism to do those types of tests, is that one that you would recommend people leverage?
100%. I mean, you can use it for free to start, right? Which is, free is a great thing for any business. I don't care whether you're a nonprofit or you're making billions in revenue. If you can start something with free and test it at free and make sure it works, then always a good thing, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So I would totally recommend that anybody that has the wherewithal to use that within their internal organization starts using that or some other platform immediately. And if you don't have the talents in your organization to execute that, because it does take some programming work and some things like that, mm-hmm. then work with a partner that can help you do that, right? And there are lots of people out there. that can help with that kind of A/B testing approach. It is something that we do. It sounds like it's something that you do, right? And so there's not, you know, just one shop out there in the world that can help support folks. There's a lot. And
right.
rather than like patting ourselves on the back, I would say test, right? Like, I don't care if it's with me or with you or with whoever, just start testing and make your stuff better.
For sure. It's just a matter of getting started. And I think that that's something that a lot of people, I know I have in the past, you know, not gotten started just because I didn't necessarily know all the answers or think I was going to be able to get it perfect. And, you know, ultimately, it's just getting started, which is the most important first step, right? Yeah. So if somebody is interested in engaging with a data team, so someone like you and your team at Nimble Gravity, what are some of the things they should consider before bringing on a specialist like you and your team?
Well, what's their data environment look like, right? Who holds the keys to the data castle, so to speak? Is it one group? Is it spread out amongst a bunch of people? Is it, you know, is it a scrappy little business that has three people doing stuff and it's one guy, right? Like, what's the environment? Is it Google Analytics? Is it, you know, data lakes on, you know, Amazon servers? What's going to have to happen? How are they going to get, you know, an external team authenticated into that environment? How are they going to make sure that those security protocols are in place to make sure everything is, you know, foundationally good? So I would consider that. And then, you know, are they used to working with diverse data sets and facing big challenges, right? Like, we always say that we like to solve tough problems, and we've done it, you know, for years across a variety of different businesses. And I think that regardless of who it is, the more differentiated data types they've been exposed to and the more complex data sets that they've been exposed to, the better, right? So you probably don't want to work with somebody who has only done work on data sets in a business that's completely different yours for, you know, decades, right? Like, say you're a nonprofit, you know, clothing company or something like that. You probably don't want to hire the oil and gas data science guy, right? So it's just going to be a disconnect in the way that they solve problems, right? And then the other thing that I would say is, regardless of whether you're nonprofit or not, you're still a business. And I think you want to work with people who have solved business challenges and that aren't just wholly academic in their approach, right? So people who have a track record of improving business outcomes as part of their background would be who I would recommend somebody go and work with.
Nice. So just looking at white papers, case studies, et cetera, from different data modelers and different data analysts and see if you can find somebody who seems to have an understanding of your particular area of influence or you know, where you, you know, they have experience in your sector, and then, you know, have expressed some sort of success in that would be one of the things that you would start with. That, I mean, that makes just a ton of sense for sure.
Yep. Yeah.
Do you see people getting too in the weeds around certain data models or you know, information that you recommend pulling back on? Or is that part of the, you mentioned curiosity early on. So, you know, part of curiosity is just, you know, going down a rabbit hole in some instances, but are there ways to know when you're just getting too far away from the core approach for people? I don't know if that's a good question or not. I'm just trying to think of...
It is. I think I know what you're driving at, right? Like getting lost in the data and hypothesizing about things that you just can't prove out, right? And like when to stop, right? Mm-hmm. So data science is a bit of an art in that fashion, right? Like and finding those correlations, right? Like, so I'll go all the way back to the beginning of our conversation and figuring out... the data sets that we could use for that regression analysis for figuring out the appliance sales thing, right? So we tried a whole bunch of other data sets and they just didn't correlate as well as housing starts and fuel prices did, right? Mm-hmm. Like we tried other manufacturing things. We tried seasonality. We tried a bunch of different stuff. And we had to say, okay, you know, like these two work, the rest don't. And we couldn't spend a whole bunch of time doing that, right? Because if we had exhaustively kind of gone down the rabbit hole of every data set in the world, like we still wouldn't be done. So, right. So you have to, you kind of have to know when to cut things off, which reminds me of a story about a really famous painter who, his agent used to have to go steal his paintings from his studio and go hang them up in art galleries because he would never quit working on them. Right. Yeah. Like, and if his agent didn't do that, he wouldn't have made any money. Right. Yeah. So you have to have this kind of sense of, when, you know, good is better than great. Right. Yep. Right. Like you can't drive for perfection constantly. And if you drive yourself down into the weeds and you're picking apart miniature data sets with low correlation and they're not coming out of a model with, you know, high relevance to what's going on, and then you've got a kind of a training, a corrective action, a group conversation of, listen, we've got to focus more on these bigger wins, these areas where there is higher correlation, where there's more outcomes that are going to be positive and possible than these theories that aren't. So,
yeah. It sounds like embracing the idea that done is better than perfect and that this is an iterative experiment that we're all running and we'll continue to make adjustments, but you know, the fact of the matter isn't perfect. Perfection just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so chasing it is not a viable use of one's time, really.
Yeah. I love that you used the word experiment because that's what it is too, right? That's a huge part of science, period, whether it's data science or, you know, chemical-based science or whatever, you experiment. And experiment implies both success and failure. Right. And it's an opportunity to learn from both of those scenarios. So,
yeah, for sure. I can't believe it's been an hour since we started talking. That's amazing. I've really had a great time learning more about your approach to data analysis and how it can be a powerful tool for any organization, any business out there. How can people find out more about what you're up to and engage with you and your team if they'd like to kind of kickstart their data analysis?
Yeah. So I think, you know, two great ways to do that are one, our website, which is www.nimblegravity.com. And the other way would be LinkedIn, right? Folks can come and find us on our LinkedIn page and follow us and hear about all the great fun things that we're doing and engage with us as they want to.
So. Well, I'll certainly share both of those links in the show notes. I love having conversations. I love talking about things and diving into new areas for both myself and our audience. But I also want people to take action. And one of the things that I really want this podcast to do is inspire people to do something after they've listened to the show. If there was one thing that you wanted people to do after listening to our conversation today, what would that be?
Go run a test or an experiment, right? Whether it's an A/B test on your website or something with data science, like go figure out how your organization can do that today.
Perfect. I'm going to go run a test on my own site and see what happens if I make a change. I haven't decided. I don't know exactly what that will be, but I'm going to dig into the data and see what kind of test I can run. Nice. Thanks so much for being on the show today. I really had a great time talking with you, Matt, and you know, thanks for being a part of the show.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Stu. I really appreciate the opportunity and hope that we can talk again in the future.
Oh, that would be lovely. Have a great day.
You too, sir.
Bye.
Bye.
And there you have it, another great episode of Relish This. Thanks again for listening. You can find past episodes of the show at relishthis.org. And remember, if you liked what you heard today, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on purpose marketing, grab your free copy of my book, Mission Uncomfortable: How Nonprofits Can Embrace Purpose-Driven Marketing to Survive and Thrive. Get your copy now at missionuncomfortablebook.com. Thanks again for listening. Come back next week, won't you?